From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Elaine Clark, in for Doug Fabrizio. In 2009, journalist Mazyar Bahari traveled to Iran to cover the country's presidential election. He knew journalism was tricky business there, but he figured he was protected by his ethics. He focused on being honest and impartial and saw his job as helping the West understand his native land. But he was arrested for being a spy and inciting demonstrations following the rigged election. The so-called evidence wasn't just his reporting. It also included a satirical interview with The Daily Show. Bahari's 118 days with his interrogator and torturer is the basis for his book and a film directed by Jon Stewart. Mazyar Bahari is in Utah. We'll talk to him about his journalism, Iran's history of oppressive regimes, and about how his captor became his vicious muse. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Elaine Clark, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. When Iranian-Canadian journalist Mazyar Bahari flew to Tehran to cover the 2009 presidential elections for Newsweek magazine, he figured it'd be a fairly quick trip. He had promised his partner Paola, pregnant with their first child, that he wouldn't travel during her pregnancy. But this story is one he couldn't resist. And he figured he'd be safe enough. Yes, journalists get arrested in Iran, but he thought he knew how to play the game. He was fair to all parties and thought by explaining Iran to the West, the regime might even appreciate his work. But that wasn't the case, and given the charges that the Revolutionary Guard made when they arrested him, it's clear there's not much he could have done to escape that fate while still doing his job well. Bahari once said he could have made an appearance on Sesame Street, and they would have accused him of sedition alongside Elmo. He did appear on Comedy Central's The Daily Show. Their contributor Jason Jones was in Tehran, and dressed as a spy, acting the hapless Westerner, he asked what makes Iran so evil. Bahari's answer would later be used against him during his 118 days in Iran's notorious Evin prison. The story of his imprisonment at the hands of his vicious and absurd jailer is the basis for his book and the film directed by The Daily Show's Jon Stewart. Mazyar Bahari is in Utah helping the University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics kick off its 50th anniversary celebration, and he's with us today in studio. We invite you to join us as well. Our phone number is 801-585-WEST, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Mazyar Bahari is a journalist, a filmmaker, and human rights activist. His documentaries and reporting have aired on the BBC and HBO, among many others. And he was a correspondent for Newsweek magazine. His book is called Rosewater, A Family Story of Love, Captivity, and Survival. Mazyar Bahari, welcome.
Very nice to be here.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I mentioned your partner, now wife. Paola was 5 months pregnant when you decided to go and cover the elections. And you had had this deal with her that you wouldn't travel during her pregnancy. But I guess this was a story too big to miss. Talk about that journalistic impulse to go and witness firsthand.
Yes. Well, you know, as journalists, every story is very important to you. But that story in specific was very important to me because in June 2009, the Iranian people, they had a chance to reform the system peacefully from within. And the Iranian government, the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, had a chance to become a legitimate leader by allowing the people of Iran to reform the system peacefully. So I thought I had to be there as an Iranian journalist, as someone who knew more about Iran than many of my Western counterparts. I thought it was my duty to be there, to document it for Newsweek magazine, for BBC, for Channel 4. So I promised Paola that I'm going to go there. I will be there for about a couple of weeks and I come back.
You called yourself an Iranian journalist, and you say in your book, I never thought of myself as foreign press. You were born in Iran, educated in Canada, living in London, writing for Newsweek magazine. Are you an Iranian journalist? Are you a Western journalist?
Well, in Iran, I was an Iranian journalist. To start with, legally, Iran does not accept dual citizenship. So even though I had a Canadian passport when I was in Iran, legally, I was regarded as an Iranian. But also, I was an Iranian journalist because I grew up in Iran. I could speak the language. I knew the culture. I had many friends and relatives that many of my Western counterparts did not have. I had many connections. So I was really an Iranian journalist. But I was an Iranian journalist who also knew about the Western media, who also worked with the Western media. So as such, I thought it was my duty to be there and record this very important moment in Iranian history. But of course, I didn't know that I would become part of that history as well.
Who's your audience?
My audience at that time?
Yeah.
My audience was the people who read Newsweek magazine. My audience were the people who watched BBC programs, Channel 4 programs, and also people who were interested in more nuanced version of Iran, because I started to work in Iran after I went back after 12 years in 1997. And from 1997 to 2009, I gained some reputation as someone who brought more nuance to the image of Iran, to the dialogue with Iran that's presented, that more than what is presented in the Western media, mainstream Western media. So I had my own audience as well.
I mentioned this a little bit in the introduction, too. You thought you'd carved out a role for yourself that would protect you from some of the dangers that journalists face. You thought the regime would appreciate that you were fair when you were reporting on them and trying to help the West understand. You even said that you censored yourself to sort of stay below the radar.
Sure.
What were the kind of things that you were doing as a journalist to keep yourself safe? And how did that affect your journalism, I wonder?
Well, we have to talk about the things that I was not doing to keep myself safe. To start with, I was not going to Israel because I knew that was the Iranian government calls it the threshold of tolerance, the red lines, and the certain subjects, red subjects. So I knew not to cross certain red lines. I did not go to Israel in order to cover the Middle East conflict. I went to Iraq a lot. I did not talk about certain subjects that was not allowed in Iran, for example, religious minorities, ethnic minorities, and also I did not criticize the supreme leader of Iran openly. These are the things that I thought I should do in order to be able to continue working in Iran. And because I knew that if I worked on any of those subjects, that would be my last article or film. But still, I pushed the envelope. I talked about certain subjects that were unprecedented in Iran. And when I was arrested, of course, my interrogators used those films and articles against me.
We'll talk more about the sort of post-election upheavals as we go along. But, you know, even as things were sort of going crazy on the ground, you felt this responsibility to stay. And we should say really clearly that you weren't naive about what could happen to you. And you say in your book, as the story goes in your extended family, trouble runs in the Bahari blood. Talk about that for a second. Talk about
your
father and your sister had both experienced.
It's a good trouble, we should tell the audience. It's not as if the Bahari family goes around and breaks the windows up, you know, shops and, you know, buses, vandalize buildings. Well, my family for decades, since, let's say, 1905, when my grandfather joined the Constitutional Revolution in Iran, fought for a more accountable, more democratic government in Iran. And then, of course, my father joined the Communist Party in Iran in the 1940s and fought for the independence of Iran. And then my sister in the 1980s fought against Ayatollah Khomeini's dictatorship. I never thought of myself as a revolutionary, as an activist, because I had seen what has happened to many ideologies and many political parties, especially after the fall of the Soviet Union. I was very much disenchanted with any kind of ideology and political party. But I thought my duty was to be a journalist, to be a good journalist, to document the events and the stories in Iran impartially and as nuanced and as detailed as possible. But what I guess I did not know, and many other people did not know, was that the information journalism in 2009 had become more dangerous to the Iranian government than any militant group, than any political party. Because what happened in 2009 in Iran was a seminal event, which was repeated in many other countries. It was the first time that the internet, the social media, was used in a social movement, in a political movement. We saw the same thing happening again in Hong Kong, in Ukraine, of course, during the Arab Spring, in this country, in Ferguson, in Baltimore. So in Iran, people experienced it for the first time. And that, of course, surprised many journalists, many pundits, but it really scared the regime.
The flow of information?
The flow of information and how people managed to mobilize themselves through social media, through Facebook, through Twitter. Because I don't think Mark Zuckerberg, even in his dreams, could have imagined that, you know, Facebook could become a tool for a social movement. And many Iranian, especially people in the government of Iran who are really not very technologically savvy, knew about the power of social media. So they were surprised by this massive movement of Iranian people, which was really mobilized through social media, through Twitter and Facebook mainly. And as a result, they had a knee-jerk reaction. They started to imprison people. They started to torture people. And what is very, I think it's important to understand about countries like Iran, governments like Iran, is that they are analog governments operating in a digital age. They are 20th century governments that can imprison people, torture people, interfere with shortwave radio signals. But when it comes to digital technology, to satellite technology, to social media, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, they don't know what to do. But what they're trying to do is to use the same old methods that they know in order to fight this new social media. So as a result, I was a victim of this knee-jerk reaction of the Iranian government to this social movement and this digital movement.
You were pretty optimistic, though, before the election. I mean, I think one friend described the atmosphere on the ground this way. It was like being in a World Cup final, but more exciting. Progressive candidate, the reformist candidate, I should say, Mousavi, was our Pele, is the way he put it. Is part of this social media, this discussion that was happening, what contributed to your optimism too beforehand, because you saw so much going on? Why the optimism? I mean, you were raised in a politically astute family. You were raised on politics.
Yeah, you would think so.
Yeah.
Now, with the hindsight, which is 2020, I can look back at those days and see that I was wrong. But many people were like me. I think our mistake was that we thought Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, was smarter than that, because we knew that he's a pragmatic person. We knew that his main priority is the survival of the regime. And we also knew that he wants to be a legitimate leader. So the main candidates, the main reformist candidates, Mir Hossein Mousavi, was not a revolutionary. He did not want to topple the regime, and he did not want to, for example, reestablish relations with the United States overnight. He just wanted to have certain reforms in order to legitimize the regime, in order to liberalize the atmosphere inside Iran. And we thought that Ayatollah Khamenei would be comfortable with that. But, of course, we were wrong.
Then came election.
Authoritarian leaders are not usually known for their wisdom. And I think he made a big mistake, Ayatollah Khamenei, because I think in the long run, what he supported in 2009, the re-election of Ahmadinejad as president, and what he supported in terms of crackdown on the press, on the people, the torture, the killing of many people, dozens of people, hundreds of arrests, that really undermined his authority, and he will pay for it in the long term.
And we'll talk more about that and what happened on Election Day and just thereafter when we get back from a break. Mazyar Bahari is with us, journalist, filmmaker, human rights activist. His book, Rosewater, is the basis of a film of the same name directed by Jon Stewart. Bahari is in Utah as a guest of the Hinckley Institute of Politics here at the University of Utah. He's helping kick off their 50th anniversary celebration, which will include a series of events throughout the year. You can go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org, for links to more information. We have to take a brief break, and we'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Elaine Clark, and for Doug Fabrizio. Mazyar Bahari has the journalist impulse to be where the story is. So in 2009, when Iran was holding what could have been historic elections, he headed there from London for Newsweek magazine. He'd promised his partner Paola, who was expecting their first child, that it would be a quick trip. What it turned into, though, was a 118 ordeal in Iran's notorious Evin prison, where Bahari was held on charges of being a spy and bringing corruption from the West. Mazyar Bahari tells his story in his book, Rosewater, the basis of the film by the same name directed by The Daily Show's Jon Stewart. Bahari is in Utah as a guest of the University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics. So on the day of the election, 3.5 hours before the polling stations were scheduled to close, one of the state-run media outlets calls the election for Ahmadinejad. 3.5 hours beforehand. How did that start changing the atmosphere on the street from this optimism to what it would become?
It was really like a dark cloud over the country. And it was, of course, the dark cloud became even darker the next morning when we woke up and we heard that Ahmadinejad had been elected with the majority of the votes, 24 million compared to 16 million by Mousavi. We knew, like the day before, on the day of the election, that the votes were rigged, that Ayatollah Khamenei and the Revolutionary Guards were not as wise as we wanted them to be. But we didn't think that they were going to humiliate people and their opponents that much. Because I think the vote rigging went beyond people's expectation. If it was 17 million for Ahmadinejad, 16 million for Mousavi, people could have accepted it.
He even lost in his home province, right? His
exactly,
home area.
Yes, which is Mousavi. Very difficult for candidates to do in Iran because people are, in certain areas, especially outside of major urban areas, people are quite tribal, still tribal, and they vote for their local boy. Not only Mousavi lost in his hometown, the other two candidates who were running against Ahmadinejad, they lost to Ahmadinejad in their hometown as well. And that was not acceptable for people. And of course, Ahmadinejad had another campaign, another rally, the victory rally after the election, and he called people who were against his vote dust and dirt, and then that was just added insult to injury, and people thought that they should do something. So people, again, through social media, they mobilized themselves and came to the streets, and for 4 days from the, I believe it was from the 23rd of June to 12th of June or 3rd, I'm not sure, I don't remember the dates exactly, but for 4 days from Monday to Friday, people came to the streets on a daily basis. Millions of people in the streets of Tehran and other cities around Iran and asking for the recounting of the vote. Again, people did not want to topple the regime. No one called for the death of the Islamic Republic. The main slogan in those demonstrations was, "Where is my vote?" Meaning, where are my rights as the citizens of the country? Where are my rights as people of Iran? We do not want to be the subject of a monarch anymore. We do not want to be the subject of the Ayatollah anymore. We want to be citizens of this country. And that was it. And again, Ayatollah Khamenei had the opportunity to accept people's call for recounting of the vote. But on the Friday, in the Friday sermons after the demonstrations, he asked people to go home. Otherwise, they would be responsible for the bloodshed. And the Saturday following the Ayatollah Khamenei's sermon, I saw some of the worst scenes that I've ever seen in my life. And I had worked in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in different parts of Africa. I've covered wars. So I had seen a lot of atrocities. But I saw young girls getting beaten by the Revolutionary Guards, older women getting beaten by the young besieged paramilitary forces, and many young people getting kicked in the head, and just humiliation. That was unbelievable. So that was the day before my arrest.
And you had your camera out.
I had my camera, but on that specific date, I could not use my camera that much. I sent two shots to back to London. But the footage maybe you're referring to, that was shot 5 days before, earlier that week.
On the siege. Yeah.
Exactly, when people attacked the besiege. Some people attacked the besiege, which is the paramilitary forces, part of the Revolutionary Guards headquarters. And there was a battle between some people and the besiege. Yeah.
And then they came for you. That was the original title of your book. And then they came for you. Nearly a week after that attack on the besiege, you were arrested from your mother's home by a man you called Rosewater, who was in prison, euphemistically referred to as your specialist, which really means interrogator and torturer, and one of the only people you actually got to speak to for quite.
Exactly.
Talk about the power.
The Iranian regime actually has become quite smart in terms of its torture methods. They assign someone to be responsible for you. So that person comes to your house and that person arrests you. That person takes you to prison. That person becomes your interrogator. And eventually, even though euphemistically they call him the specialist, informally the prison guards call him your owner. So he basically owns you. So sometimes when my prison guards were taking me from my solitary confinement to the interrogation room, they were saying that your owner wants to see you, meaning that that person has the total control over you. And because you're kept in solitary confinement, because you're denied of all your senses, because you cannot see anything besides you're blindfolded. But and even if when you're in the solitary confinement and you take off the blindfold, you cannot see anything except for the walls around you. You cannot touch anything except for the walls. Basically, you're denied of all your senses. And as we show it in the film, Evin Prison is not a backward prison that you see in Zero Dark Thirty. It is a very modern institution. It is like a hospital if they tortured and imprisoned people in hospitals, I guess. It's an institution. It's a clinic. And when the interrogator takes you to the interrogation room, you know that he is the only one. He's your only connection with the rest of the world, because you don't have access to the radio, to the internet, of course, to any newspaper, to anything except for the Quran and a book of prayers inside
your cell. But you don't read Arabic.
Read Arabic, and yes, and the book of prayers was really, really, I mean, I don't know what to say.
It did not make sense.
It was not, let's say, Brothers Karamazov. Yeah, it wasn't a compelling reading. And so, yeah, so he has total control over you. So he can really manipulate you, and he can really control your physical being, but also control your mind. He wants to control your mind. And because many of the prisoners in Iran, they're coming from a religious and traditional background, they are on the same wavelength with their interrogator. So the interrogator really knows how to manipulate their vulnerabilities, how to manipulate their loved ones, his love for their loved ones, and they have total control over them.
Well, even if you're not religious, I mean, family was a powerful tool he had in his toolkit with you, too. Your mother, your wife. I mean, he...
He had and he had not.
Okay.
Because what I had was a life experience that he did not know anything about. He had ideas about that life experience. But I had read books that he did not know anything about. I had listened to music that he did not know anything about. I had seen film that he did not know anything about. So I managed immediately to create this inner universe for myself that was somehow alien to him. I managed to have this inner space in myself in which I took shelter in, and I could watch films in that inner universe, even in the interrogation room that he did not know anything about. And I could have a soundtrack that was alien to him. That's why I started to listen to Leonard Cohen in my head, of course, while I was in prison, because I knew that Leonard Cohen, this Canadian Jewish singer-songwriter, Mr. Rosewater did not know anything about him.
Stravinsky, which you shared a love with your sister.
And it was something that I think even though he thought that, and I had to give the impression that he was controlling my life, I had some solace inside me. Mm-hmm. And that really, I think, helped me. And if there's any argument for culture in any country, I think I am the real example for it, that government should really invest in culture. Because without culture, people become like Mr. Rosewater or his cronies.
Well, and here he was, this terrible, you know, abuser and manipulator. But it strikes me something your father said, the most dangerous animal is a donkey, right? Because of its stupidity and unpredictability, which seems to me to sum up Rosewater, right, in a nutshell. For as vicious as he was, there was something kind of pathetic, even humorous about him, which, I mean, we can talk about more, but here you were charged with being a spy and with propagating dissent, really being this mastermind for the West in Iran. They couldn't prove it, and so they started grasping for
evidence.
Absurd evidence. Of course, the idea of satire, right over his head, right? Like, beyond his grasp. And they'd use this interview that I mentioned earlier that you had done with Jason Jones as sort of proof that you were a spy. I want to play a little bit from this, but set this up. What was Jason Jones? What was the premise? What was he going for?
Basically, what happened was that before my arrest, I was working on a BBC documentary, BBC Panorama, and they called me from the Daily Show. They said, we are doing this program in Iran, and we would like to interview you. I was editing in a hotel room with our presenter. I went to the lobby, and unbeknownst to any of us, we were being watched by the intelligence agents. And so I sat down with Jason and his producer, Tim Greenberg. I gave them some information about Iran. I also gave them some names of different people they could talk to, different artists they could interview, a rapper that they could interview. And then I did my own interview with Jason, and we didn't think that much about it because I had done so many interviews during that time with CNN, with BBC, with different European channels, and the Jason Jones interview was just one of them.
He's in dark sunglasses. He's in a Palestinian scarf, a kafeah, and he's saying he's, you know, this is a clandestine meeting. Let's listen to a moment from the Daily Show.
The one thing I could understand was that this entire country is evil.
The first thing to know about Iran is that it's not evil. Iranians and Americans, they have much more in common than they have difference.
What do I have in common with you?
Who is number one enemy of the United States?
Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda is also the number one enemy of Iran. According to Al-Qaeda members, any Shia, any Iranian has to be killed. And if you kill an Iranian, you would go to heaven and you will have 72 virgins.
Enough of his Western-educated Newsweek doublespeak.
And so there you go. Rosewater said, how dare you compare America to Iran?
Exactly. I think what really incensed them about that interview was the fact that I said Iran and the U.S., they have more similarities than differences. And the fact that there is another part to the interview that you did not play, in which that I say calling Iran part of an axis of evil is as idiotic as burning the flag of the United States in Iran. And I still believe that. I still believe that Iran and the United States have much more in common and they can work together about on their differences. But, of course, my captors, my interrogator, they are coming from a group of people within the Iranian government who are thriving in chaos. They are thriving in conflict. Stability is their real nemesis. Stability is what they're really afraid of. So they want to be in this constant state of conflict with the United States and the rest of the world. And for them, someone like me who is for rapprochement, for the normalization of relations between Iran and the United States, is the enemy, is someone to be afraid of. Hence, they thought that I was a spy, that I was doing something really surreptitious.
Because spies go on television and say, I'm a spy.
And they have their own show.
And they have their own show, so they can broadcast it to everybody.
But the funny thing is that, it is funny when we're talking about it in Utah, it was not that funny in the dark interrogation room in Iran. The funny thing is that the Jason Jones interview was one of the most intelligent piece of evidence that they brought forward because it happened. It was an interview. He said that he was a spy. They told me that they asked me about my connections with Anton Chekhov, the 19th century Russian playwright. They thought that he's a Zionist agent because Chekhov sounds Jewish to them, and I was a member of a Facebook fan club. But of course, the cherry on the cake, the icing on the cake, was my connections with Pauly Shore.
Your deep, deep connections.
Exactly,
with
because I was a member of a Pauly Shore fan club
with like 12 members, right?
Exactly,
it was a joke.
And they wanted to know about this, secret agent called Pauly Shore. Many of your listeners, the young listeners, may not know Pauly Shore.
And
I can assure them that, you know, they're not missing much.
Google that and then feel sorry for that you now know who that is. Some bloggers criticized The Daily Show for airing those interviews when they did. But I know, you know, The Daily Show had called you and you had given them permission to move forward. It would have made any difference whatsoever if those hadn't have been aired.
And those bloggers, they would have criticized Daily Show for another reason. You know, the thing about the digital revolution is that it has democratized information and it has brought many good things to people's lives. But also it has allowed many stupid people to have their own media. People who you could never hear about, or someone who would just be locked up in a mental asylum, has now a Twitter account and a Facebook account and many followers maybe. And they are becoming, their own medium. And they criticized The Daily Show for something that they had not done. And I had to defend The Daily Show so many times after I came out that they had nothing to do with my arrest, that it was just the stupid evidence that the Iranian government brought forward. Yeah. And you really cannot prepare yourself for that kind of stupidity. I mean, what could The Daily Show? How could they guess that a joke could go so wrong?
Well, and it actually ended up leading to this partnership in many ways with Jon Stewart. And, you know, it's interesting to see in the film, which I wouldn't call funny, but it certainly uses humor. Like you were talking about how clinical the prison is, and you're in the person playing you in the film is, you know, dial 9 before you can call right home. Yeah. It's just these moments of banality, and it's sort of interesting how humor has become a tool for you. And I wonder what role Jon Stewart played in bringing that to the film.
I think Jon was attracted to this story because of the humor in it. I don't think that there is. There's only one extra joke about New Jersey in the film that is not in the book, and it did not happen in real life. But everything that you see in the film happened in real life. And all the joke, all these ridiculous events that you see in the film, they're based on reality. And it is just natural that whenever a group of people think that they can create an ideal world with such imperfect human beings on this earth, it is just ridiculous. And then if someone thinks that they can go to heaven by torturing people, by lying to people, it is, of course, not funny to the people when they are in prison and interrogation room. But when you look at it from outside with a bit of distance, it is ridiculous. I was even laughing at my interrogator and the stupidity of my interrogator when I was going back to my cell after hours of being physically abused. He was punching my head. He was punching my legs. He was kicking me. And he was calling me different names. He was telling me about the ideas that he had in the West, especially about sexual relations in the West. And, of course, I was not laughing in the interrogation. I was laughing inside. But when I went back to my cell, I was in pain. I was in total pain. I have migraine, and my head was exploding. But I couldn't stop laughing because he was so ridiculous and idiotic.
Maziar Bahari. He's a journalist and filmmaker, the author of the book Rosewater. It's the basis for the film he created with The Daily Show host Jon Stewart. The film is available on Amazon and iTunes. Bahari is here in Utah, kicking off the University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics 50th anniversary celebration. We have to take another quick break. We'll be back. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Elaine Clark, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. Our guest today is Iranian-born journalist and filmmaker Maziar Bahari, whose book Rosewater tells the story of his interrogation and torture in Iran's notorious Evin prison. He spent 118 days, 12 hours, and 54 minutes there. Bahari's experience is one that is endured by hundreds of journalists and thousands of activists in Iranian prisons still today, which is why Bahari tells his story. His book is also the basis for the film Rosewater, which he created with The Daily Show's Jon Stewart. Maziar Bahari is in Utah as a guest of the Hinckley Institute of Politics here at the University of Utah. You mentioned this a little bit in passing, this sort of two lives that you had to leave in prison, you had to live in prison. And it really seems like that was a skill that you brought from your family, from just life in Iran as a general
By
rule.
Growing up like, in Iran, actually.
Yeah. Talk about
because
that.
In Iran, you have to be at least two different people when you are growing up. One is your social persona, the way you behave outside of your house, the way that you have to abide by the government rules in terms of how you have to dress, how you have to behave, what you have to say. And the other persona is the one you are inside your house. That, you know, I have seen more alcoholics. You know, it might be difficult for your listeners in Utah to believe that there are more alcoholics in Iran than any other country I've ever seen. There are many parties in Iran. Women, they behave totally differently in Iran. I mean, when I was growing up in Iran, I remember we were listening to, I don't know, David Bowie and REM at home. And then we were going out and we had to chant revolutionary slogans. So when you grow up in such authoritarian regime, especially an ideological authoritarian regime, you develop these two different personalities. So as an Iranian, I knew how to do that. But what really helped me in this process was my family history, but especially my family's interest in the other things in the world, the other countries, other ideas, other arts, music. So, and the fact that I was exposed to different kinds of music and film and literature from early on in my life, that I knew certain poems that I could recite in my head. And then, of course, I was fortunate enough to live for 12 years outside of Iran and then being able after that to travel around the world. By the time I was arrested, I was counting the number of countries that I had been to. I'd been to like 75 different countries. So that really, really helped me to survive and create that inner universe for myself.
So you had these survival mechanisms going on while you're in prison. Of course, having really no idea because you had no communication what was happening outside of prison.
Sure.
Your now wife, Paola, Newsweek, Channel 4, all on this huge campaign. And we don't have time to tell all of those stories. And there's so many great stories in the book. But because of their activism, you really became more of a liability than an asset to the Iranian government. But not everyone has that weight behind them.
No, and that's why I'm here talking to you. That's why I'm here in Utah. That's why I wrote the article. As soon as I came out, I did the interviews. All of this is part of the process that started in prison because I knew in my, even though I was isolated and I did not have any communication with the rest of the world, I knew in my heart of hearts that my friends and my family, they were campaigning for me. I knew that.
Even when you're told they weren't.
Even when I was told that they were not. And I knew people like Ted Koppel and John Stewart. People knew me. They knew my name. They knew how to pronounce my name. And I knew that when I come out of prison, I have to campaign for people who are totally unknown to other people, who are statistics to people. Because right now there are 44 journalists in prison in Iran. Since 2009, almost 400 journalists and professional journalists and citizen journalists have been imprisoned in Iran. These are not numbers. These 400 people, they are fathers, they are brothers, sisters, mothers, wives of different people. These are human beings that we have to talk about. I have to basically, because of my privileged position, I have to be their voice. I have to bring their voice to the international arena, and I have to be able to, I have to help them in any way I can. And yeah, so when I was in prison, I was being told by my interrogator that no one knows about you, no one campaigns for you. And of course, as we see in the film and as I say in the book, one day one of the guards, just by mistake, said, "Mr. Hillary Clinton, come out of your cell. Your specialist wants to see you." And as soon as I heard Hillary Clinton's name, the Secretary of State of the United States talking about me, even though I'm not an American citizen, I knew that there was a campaign going on for me, and that was the best day of my imprisonment.
Even today, I mean, there's another Ahmadinejad couldn't run again because he had run up against term limits. Hassan Rouhani is president now, and he made election promises that there'd be a better working environment for journalists. But yeah, where does that stand? You wrote a letter with several other journalists back in October to Rouhani.
Yes, Rouhani promised many things that he's not in charge of, that
sound
he
familiar?
Cannot deliver.
A little bit of a
exactly.
cycle. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and if it happens in this country,
yes,
I guess.
Indeed.
Yeah, Americans, they can identify with that. So Rouhani is a step forward from Ahmadinejad. I mean, we cannot deny that. At least he represents a branch of the Iranian government that knows having better relations with the rest of the world, respecting human rights, respecting press freedom is good for business. But Rouhani is only in charge of, as the president, he's only in charge of the executive branch. He's not in charge of the courts. He's not in charge of the Revolutionary Guards. And those branches of the government, in order to put pressure on Rouhani, they have made the lives of journalists much harder since Rouhani has come to power in June 2013. There are more executions in Iran, especially in the last few months, that there are 6 people getting executed on a daily basis.
Wow.
It is just mind-boggling the amount of atrocities that are going on in Iran. You cannot blame Rouhani, of course, for these atrocities, but Rouhani should be blamed. Rouhani and his government, especially his foreign minister, Zarif, they should be criticized for their failure to talk on the behalf of the victims. So we, as human rights activists, as press freedom activists, we have to put pressure on the Rouhani government that they have either do something about the situation of human rights in Iran, or if they cannot do anything, they should express that. They should tell people that they are helpless, that they need people's help in order to improve the situation.
You mentioned right before we went on the air a new project that you're doing, Journalism is Not a Crime. Tell me about that. Tell us about that.
Journalism is Not a Crime, which is a website as well now, and it's going to be much improved in about 2-3 weeks' time. Journalismisnotacrime.com is a project that I started last year, and its purpose is to help Iranian journalists by document what happens to them. So everyone who is arrested in Iran is presented in the on the website. Right now we have about 250 names, faces, bios on the website. It will be 400, and of course, unfortunately, it will grow. And we also provide legal help to the Iranian journalists, because when people are arrested, when their property is confiscated, when they are interrogated, they do not know about their legal rights. The families of journalists are being lied to by the interrogators and the police, so they have to know about their legal rights. And also we provide psychological help to Iranian journalists. And this project, we hope that it can be international as well, so people in different countries, they can communicate with each other, because Iran is not the only country that journalists are under pressure. There are people in China, in Russia, in Eritrea, in Turkey, in many other countries who are going through the same ordeal as Iranian journalists.
You did make it in time to see your daughter born. And your wife has never been to Iran. Your daughter, of course, not in Iran. You can't go home for fear of arrest. I mean, they did pass a sentence.
In absentia.
In absentia. So you can't go home. And I wonder how this experience has changed the kinds of stories you have access to. I mean, you've been reporting on Iran for so long. Or how it changed the kind of stories that you want to tell.
It has changed my ability to talk about Iran. I mean, I'm glad that I came out of Iran because even if I was not going to prison, I would not be able to work freely in Iran. Many of my colleagues who are in Iran, they cannot work freely. They can be they're always under threat of arrest. They're always under threat of torture. And I can just explain that when I was in Iran, I was like a diver. I was like a diver who was going through the society, through the, you know, under the skin of the society, trying to find different stories and talk about them. And right now, I'm like a pilot that goes above the country. I am in touch with people on a regular basis, on a daily basis, talking to them via Skype, via telephone, by email, by Facebook, and I am hearing the stories. We have I started a website called IranWire.com 2 years ago. So we provide a forum for Iranian journalists to share their news, disseminate news, and find a new audience for their stories internationally and also inside the country. It has become one of the most successful Iranian websites in a very short amount of time because Iranians want to know more about their country. And it's both in Persian and English, IranWire.com. And so, yes, I think I've not being able to go to Iran. It's like losing a limb. But I've lost a limb. What can I do? I have to continue to work and I have to be able to help my people. But also I have to continue to do what I love to do, which is making films, being involved in the media.
Final question. You came out of prison with the resolve to, as you put it, do your best to defeat Rosewater and his masters in any way you could. What did that defeat look like to you?
The defeat is not to become like them. The defeat is to not holding any grudges, not to seek revenge. The defeat happened actually inside prison because when I went to prison, I was 42 years old, so I was not a young man. And I knew that from experience, anger is a very negative action. So I knew I could sublimate that anger, that those emotions into something more positive. And I think I have defeated Rosewater and his masters in my own way, but not becoming like them. Yeah.
Journalist Maziar Bahari, he's the author of Rosewater, a family story of love, captivity, and survival. It's the basis for the film Rosewater, directed by The Daily Show's Jon Stewart. The film is available on iTunes and on Amazon. Maziar Bahari is in Utah as a guest of the University of Utah's Hinckley Institute of Politics, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Braden Child. We have technical direction from Tim Slover. The show is produced by myself and Benjamin Bombard. Our executive producer is Doug Fabrizio. I'm Elaine Clark.